Deutsche Welle. Inspired Minds.
Hello and a very warm welcome to this edition of Inspired Minds. I'm Brendan O'Shea. Today we meet the librettist Amanda Holden.
Perhaps all musicians are kind of hybrids because everything else you do in music informs what you do in later life. But I feel like a kind of musical pile-up because I've always been a bit obsessed with languages. I've been obsessed with opera because actually I didn't like it when I was a teenager. I thought it was a bit too highfaluting and posh for me. And I just hated not understanding the words that were being sung.
There are many great composer-librettist partnerships that come to mind easily. Mozart and Da Ponte, or Richard Strauss and Hugo von Hofmannsthal, to name a few. Yet mostly, we associate an opera almost entirely with its composer. Well, Amanda Holden has been translating opera librettos since 1985. She's also translated many works for the stage, including concert works, plays and about 50 opera libretti of varying repertoire. Amanda has worked with all of Britain's opera companies, most extensively for the English National Opera. Initially, she studied music at Oxford, then went on a scholarship to London's Guildhall School, where she later taught piano. Her early career was as a freelanced accompanist, teacher, music therapist and typist on the sixth edition of Grove's Dictionary of Music. Indeed, in the 80s, she founded the Viking Penguin Opera Guides. Her most recent edition from 2005, the Concise Penguin Guide to Opera. And she hopes to republish the work on the internet soon. Well, Amanda Holden's latest libretto was written for the opera called Bliss by the composer Brett Dean. It's based on a book by the same name by the acclaimed author Peter Carey. Bliss opened Hamburg State Opera's current season, and it was on this occasion I caught up with Amanda Holden and asked her firstly about her journey to writing opera libretti.
I actually went on a scholarship to the Guildhall after I did a degree at Oxford University in music, where I was actually so bad at harmony and counterpoint I spent my whole time kind of singing and dancing, organising operas actually, commissioning operas and singing in them and so on. Yeah, I went to Guildhall because I wanted to be a piano accompanist, because I loved working with singers, and that was my ambition, to be the best ever piano accompanist, or as good as my heroes, who were Gerald Moore, Benjamin Britten, wonderful pianist, amazing. And I had a really wonderful musical education. I grew up in London, and music surrounded me all the time.
But of course, it's all that singing and all that opera that you started to get yourself involved with in Oxford that's actually played a wonderful role in the rest of your life, right?
I think that's absolutely true. I was thinking it's a very extraordinary thing, but I think perhaps all musicians are kind of hybrids because everything else you do in music informs what you do in later life, if that doesn't sound really stupid. But I feel like a kind of musical pile-up because I've always been a bit obsessed with languages. I've been obsessed with opera because actually I didn't like it when I was a teenager. I thought it was a bit too highfaluting and posh for me. And I just hated not understanding the words that were being sung. And for various reasons, I found myself translating operas. When I was nearly 40, I was suddenly found myself doing that. And it was kind of fun. And allied to that, I had a passionate interest in opera and I wanted to know more about it. One of the part-time jobs I had when I was a student was working at Grove's Dictionary of Music, the 20-volume edition that came out in 1981. And in the early 70s, I was there making their first card index for a couple of shillings an hour. And I also then worked for Penguin Viking.
You did.
A very, very large opera dictionary.
You did, one of the most important ones, actually. Well, there wasn't an opera dictionary like this around before you did yours, right?
It was the single largest. I say was, with a tear in my eye. And if you could try and say this very loudly, it's very, very sad that Penguin have ceased to print it. It's out of print. They told me it didn't sell fast enough. And unfortunately, I didn't feel that it was really well promoted. And of course, it's also very expensive to print an opera encyclopedia. But I have hopes of putting it on the internet.
It actually did exactly all those things that you were annoyed with about opera. It actually brought it down to layman's terms.
I think I do have an obsession with the theatre being communicative and being quite easy to pick up. I really don't like productions and operas that are so baffling that you come out thinking you don't really know what it was all about. But I have actually worked quite hard to sometimes work that out for myself, and I think it is quite a challenging art. But I quite like a challenge as well. So, in fact, I never ever would have dreamt in my wildest dreams that I ever would be asked to write a libretto, or indeed that I actually would be able to.
Yes, but one of your best friends, of course, along the way was Benjamin Britten's librettist, Eric Crozier. That must have been a wonderful, wonderful encounter.
You see, I've been incredibly lucky, but Eric was a sort of formative person to meet. And actually, I didn't meet him until I was 5 or 6 years into this opera translating career. And I have actually translated about 50 librettos. So I know how they work, or at least I think I know how they don't work as well. I just happened to meet him at the Britten Peers School in Auburn. He became a very, very close friend very briefly before he died. And it's part of the pile-up, meeting somebody like that and talking to him about what it was like directing the first Peter Grimes, what it was like trying to get Britten to look at the sketches he and E.M. Forster had made for Billy Budd. It was absolutely fascinating. But I think actually more formative than that was another extraordinary thing that happened. When I went to Oxford, I was at a ladies' college where there was no music tutor. So I was farmed out to another college where the music tutor was a gentleman called Egon Velesch, an Austrian composer, who had studied with Schoenberg alongside Berg and Webern. And my goodness me, I can hardly believe this happened to me. It was just so marvellous. And actually, what we haven't said is that I'm really not a very literate person. I write entirely from the point of view of hearing what I write. And so that's another mountain that I'm still clambering up and down, which is reading. So when I was asked to read Peter Carey's Bliss, having read that and thought, wow, this is quite a challenge, I then did set to and read just about everything else that Peter Carey had written. And at the same time, though I'd heard of Brett Dean, I'd only been to, I think, one or two concerts of his music before I started work on this piece. So there was something else I needed to get to know. And that's actually a great privilege. And you add them to the pile. And then on it went, the actual construction process of finding the words that would suit this music, that would be the conduit from that novel.
I'm trying to imagine the process of taking a novel by a well-known Booker Prize-winning author and turning it into a libretto. It must be a bit like carving up a painting in some ways in order to make it fit to music. Or how does one... Can you explain the process to me? Because I'm just trying to work it out.
I do follow my nose or my ears, and hopefully my eyes as well. I read the book 3 times, and I think I was baffled at first. I thought, goodness me, how can I turn this into an opera? But I didn't really know very much about the commission then or what was going to happen. Second time I read it, I thought, I think I'm getting into this. I'm really getting to know it. And then when the third time I read it, I began to really kind of absorb it. It's like doing a translation. I had to know the book in order to somersault it out again as something else. Not a translation in this case, because, of course, there are far too many words to use many words that are actually in the novel. I mean, people...
No, but it is a translation of an idea, isn't
it? It was a translation of the ideas, but it's also a distillation or condensation. And actually, I know this sounds a bit stupid thing to say, but I don't think I'm really an intellectual, and I think I'm a bit impatient. And what I really wanted to find, first of all, was a framework. So to take it right down to the lowest common denominator, the bits you can't do without, the story, how many characters you need.
You actually renamed two of the characters. That was your decision, right?
Well, that was entirely a practical decision. In the book, the wife is called Bettina, and I called her Betty. It's easier to say. It's slightly sluttier. I think it suits her better. You have Harry, David, Lucy. So why not have another two-syllable name? They seem to fit together like that. The other name I changed was Honey Barbara, which I think is too much of a mouthful. And anyway, Honey Bee is rather sweeter and more charming. And anyway, she's a beekeeper. The other name I changed was Joel.
Which is very hard to sing, isn't it? Joel.
Exactly. Yes. That's precisely the reason. Yeah. As I said, I don't write words to read. I write words for people to hear. At least I try to, because that's what they're for. But these words are for the audience and for the singers, because the singers have to inhabit the roles. They have to be satisfactory people. You have to feel you know them. I talked to a playwright friend of mine, and I said, how do you know when you're writing a play? When are you ready to get started? He said, when I feel I know what these characters are going to say. And that was a great hint to have thrown at me, because I think I had to do that with the novel. I had to get to know these people. Obviously, it's my take on them, but I had to turn them into operatic people, but as well as part of a family or whatever else they are. It was fun. I had a lot of help too, because when I'd done the draft, I have to say this, I had my 60th birthday party, and my son said, Mum, are you going to retire now you're 60? I said, well, actually, I'm on a plane next week to Melbourne because there's this composer I'm working with. And so that was very exciting. So we discussed everything. We had met a couple of times the previous year while I was drafting the libretto. So he had his finger on the button, but his finger was kind of the other side of the world, you know, so I had to get on with it, which was very good. But I knew he was there if I needed him, and we did communicate quite a lot, but not obsessively. But this 10 days was crucial in Melbourne, and I think then we hammered it, we nailed it, we jammed it, and all the time, in retrospect, his head wasn't just working out these phrases, these words. The music was forming in his head, because when I left Melbourne, he went off like a hurricane, and the short score was completed within the year.
Who's boss, the librettist or the composer?
I'm sure every partnership is different, and that goes for marriages and everything else in life. So I've written 5 librettos, and so I've had different experiences all the time. But the first article I wrote for the Opera Australia website, I actually chose the title, and it is called The Composer is the Boss. Ah. And I feel that very strongly. Operas are by Mozart, Puccini, Verdi, Wagner and so on. And though you very nicely and sweetly said that librettos perhaps aren't appreciated enough, I think they're just hacks. I mean, they are there to enable this music. It's a very important job, but it's still a job. It's still Brett's opera. He has been fantastically generous all the time and acknowledged that he says it's partly mine too, but I think it's really all his. But we had a great time working, and I would say we had a really lovely working relationship, really, because he's such a nice man. And he listened to my ideas, and there was a great sense of energy and purpose about writing this opera, because he'd been longing to do it for such a long time. And also, I had quite a short deadline. So, in fact, I never really work on a project without being obsessed by it. So it was probably just as well that I had to complete it within the year. And I did!
Opera librettist Amanda Holden speaking to me there. And if you'd like to hear this edition of Inspired Minds again, or subscribe to Inspired Minds as a podcast, then do check out our website. You'll find it at dw-world.de/inspiredminds. Simone Fischer helped put together today's programme, but from me, Brendan O'Shea, it's goodbye from the studios of Deutsche Welle Radio, Bonn, Germany.